My name is Michael Arndt, and today's session is tentatively entitled Plays That Cracked the Iron Curtain. And I'm not really sure how appropriate that title is, because I don't know if the plays we'll be reading from today actually did the cracking or the eliminating or knocking down of the wall or whatever. But I think what I'm going to talk about today and what we're going to share in some of the readings is the overall sense of what's happened over the last couple of years, both in the Soviet Union and also in Europe. For those of us, and I was born in 1946, so I'm talking specifically about my generation or younger, that were born after World War II, our vision of the world was pretty well decided by what happened in World War II and how things were divided up and mapped out and parceled out. And we've been living pretty much, unless you also count Africa, I guess, which has had more changes in my lifetime, but our world has been pretty static until this last year. So it's been pretty amazing about the spectacular transformation that's happened, and also the place of the arts in that transformation. And as I talked for some of you that were here the other day, best demonstrated by some of the things that happened in Czechoslovakia with a playwright president. I want to read to sort of kick us off, to give you an idea of the week, a week in Czechoslovakia at the end of November in 1989, just last November. The reading I'm taking, reading is from a diary from a high school sophomore in Prague. And I think you can get a sense both of how theater was important to what happened in Czechoslovakia, but also how rapidly and how wonderfully things happened. November 20th, Monday. In the evening, we went to the theater, but they were not playing. We could not even have a discussion with the actors because the Minister of Culture demanded that the theaters be locked. But we stayed in front of the theater anyhow. An actor read the call to strike by theater students. All theaters in the country are joining. A representative of the university students, who also joined the strike, read our demands. November 21st, Tuesday. Today my school began a one-week strike. We put together our own petition to the government. The whole city feels good. Strangers talk to each other expressing, finally people are talking publicly, expressing their opinion about the present political situation. The class president does not want to get involved. I have been elected to the strike coordinating committee. November 23rd, Thursday. We had a wonderful discussion in school with Miklos Huba, an environmentalist, Peter Bruduk and Peter Rufus, actors, the editor of the newspaper Pravda, and head of the student union. The second discussion today was with two members of the Communist Party. We asked them many questions about the 1968 occupation, about Maxim Gorky's support for Stalin's concentration camp for intellectuals, the support of our communist writers and artists for the execution of the theatrical director Meyerhold. November 24th, Friday. Today is my birthday. I'm 15 years old. I always get a lot of gifts for my birthday, but my greatest gift was the resignation of the secretary of the Communist Party, Milos Jakas. I celebrated my birthday by going to a demonstration. November 30th, Thursday. Today we had live TV coverage of a meeting of the Slovak National Theater. In the Slovak National Theater, Václav Havel and others from Prague Civic Forum were present. The constitutional guarantee of the leading role for the Communist Party has been struck from the Constitution. The Soviet occupational army will leave our country. We were all crying. Which I think is highly dramatic. And for me, especially being a theater person, the pride, as I mentioned the other day, of the center of the meetings taking place in theaters and music auditoriums and places throughout the country, and the artists being on the front lines and leading that very peaceful revolution is something really exciting. The preparation for what happened in Czechoslovakia and East Germany and Romania and today, the kind of things that's happening throughout the world with artists is very exciting. I just wrote down some of the things that have happened. Peru's greatest novelist and playwright, and some of you may know him, Mario Vargas Llosa, and I think that's the way you say his last name, campaigned for president of Peru just recently. In Poland, outstanding theater and film director Andrzej Wajda has been elected to the parliament. In Russia, an actor, Nikolai Gabenko, has become Minister of Culture. And in Czechoslovakia, Havel has appointed a distinguished critic, Milos Lukas, as Czech Minister of Culture. Actually putting artists in positions of power, which is really exciting to me. Part of what we have to do to understand what's happening worldwide, and I think the United States maybe is a little behind in this, and the leadership I think we're going to find in the arts is really going to come from other parts of the world. The United States for many years has felt that they are the repository of the cultural heritage of the world, and it's unfortunate that Rambo does reach into all parts of the world in all different kinds of reproductions. But I think to understand what has happened in the world, you need to understand the idea of two cultures that have existed and the position of culture. Cultures need their artists, and people need their cultures. And for many years, artists have had their cultures hidden, or their artistic works hidden and kept and cherished underground or privately. I put at the top of the board this quote by Hannah Arendt, which is no relation to Michael Arendt. There's an E in there that I don't have in my name. But I think it's really a wonderful statement, and it's something open for your reaction to as well, so I appreciate the response. But artworks clearly are superior to all other things, since they stay longer in the world than anything else. They are the worldliest of all things. I don't know if anybody wants to react to that. It's one of those statements that you go, what? But at the same time, I really like it, because when we think about things that are cherished in all cultures and things that survive, which are those things that eventually end up in museums, what generally are those things? They're usually the works of art of those particular cultures. I especially next week when, and I urge you to come to Heidi's class this afternoon as well, when I think about Shakespeare, that's how I feel about him. You know, isn't this wonderful that we have probably the greatest practitioner of the English language, and we still have that today? And it's vital, and there are theaters all over the country doing Shakespeare yet today. You know, 400 years, and that we do Greek theater yet today. And so I think it's really important to understand this nature of culture. But what has happened in countries in which there is oppression, the culture generally is one of the first things that is shut down or formalized, where everyone is made to fit into a certain definition of what is appropriate art, what is appropriate music, what is appropriate drama and theater. And in the case of drama and theater, the first thing that usually goes, as happened after Shakespeare died, and with the removal of the throne, the first thing to be burnt, along with churches, along with Catholic churches, were the theaters. And theater was stamped out immediately, because theater is too provocative. And so I think it's important for us in the West, especially remember, and next week I hope to do a session and maybe even a forum on the National Endowment for the Arts and the nature of censorship, which I believe is a real threat to artists today in the United States. So we say, yeah, that happens over there. But I'm really concerned about how it affects us as American citizens, and that it can happen if we let it happen to us. Yes?
The last I heard was that that censorship plank didn't get through.
Well,
but I mean, I don't think the war is over yet.
The war isn't over yet. What happened, the last I heard last week before I came up here, the advisory committee to the chair of the National Endowment of the Arts, the advisory committee unanimously recommended that this statement of the loyalty oath, so-called the censorship statement, be struck from the endowment. Requirements, but that was only a recommendation.
Okay. It wasn't the committee voting on it yet.
No, that was only a recommendation to the committee. And so, whatever Frommeyer does for that. To get an understanding of what the before and after kind of situation that happened, I want to use the Soviet Union as a prime example, because since 1985, under Gorbachev, we have existed with glasnost and perestroika. And as a result, the artists have been some of the first people that have really enjoyed this freedom of perestroika. Last week, there was a woman up here, Eileen O'Connell, an actress from Seattle, who had traveled to the Soviet Union and is going back and has done plays in the Soviet Union. And she was talking about how wonderfully exciting it is in the Soviet Union now, because of the freedom that they have to do plays, to have all kinds of plays being done. And what we have to understand before we understand what's happened is understand what had happened. Generally, in the Soviet Union, the kind of theater that was done was called socialist realism or politicized theater. And the basic structure of that kind of theater was that there was always an upbeat treatment of the proper issues. That there was the inevitable triumph of the positive character according to party lines, according to party doctrines. And humor, if it was presented, it was very rare. And if it was presented, it was a very cynical, satirical humor directed at enemies of the state or ideas that were against the state ideas. And to give you an example of that, I can call on Robert, my faithful reader, to come. We're going to do a short demonstration of a play, and these are called, this is from a book called The Five of the Best Soviet Plays of the 1970s. This is an English book printed in Russia in the 70s, and it is very highly politicized. The introduction of the book, and I'll just read a paragraph from that, says, "Many theater people from the West visiting the USSR are puzzled by the Soviet stage's preoccupation with problems at the point of production. And indeed, their perplexity is understandable. The point of concentration in many Western countries is the bedroom, not the workplace. Sex, not production, is considered the basic material of much of the Western drama today. Thus, while at first it may appear strange and even incomprehensible, we believe many of our readers will be fascinated by the depiction of an entirely new system of production relations that such plays as Alexander Gilman's Feedback unfold. The playwright himself is concerned about this problem of communication. Even without the distortions of Soviet life so common in the West, it does constitute a problem." Which obviously was a party line contrast between the bad West and the good Soviet Union. But the kind of plays that were done were usually based on historical party line plays. This is a play based, it's called Revolutionary Etude, Blue Horses on Red Grass. And it's based on the last 20 years of Lenin's life. It takes place at the end of Lenin's life. And the play is a recreation of a party congress that happened in about 1922. And Lenin is just at the end of his life, and it contains a lot of his speeches, but it also contains this very telling commentary, which is a documentary presentation of party philosophy. And we're just going to read a little, and it consists of a series of questions, and the director of the youth forum responding to questions from an audience. "What's the situation with respect to culture today?"
"Ah, the situation as regards culture today, comrades, is very good. We have destroyed the old world. On its ruins, we are building a lofty palace of labor and freedom, an integral part of which is a working class, a purely proletarian culture."
"What is proletarian culture?"
"It is a culture created by the proletariat itself. The proletariat is now rearing new artists and writers from its ranks. By the way, anyone who wants to participate, just give me your name. These proletarian artists and writers must be independent in their creative work and must be immune to the pernicious influence of the bourgeois and peasant writers. Just judge for yourselves, comrades. A worker, if he can handle a pen or a brush, will be able to express himself directly. Right?"
"Right!"
"Whereas an intellectual can only give us his view of the worker on the job secondhand, right?"
"Right."
"But why should we put up with secondhand stuff? Now then, a new proletarian culture will emerge, and it is already being created by the workers who remain right on the job. Proletarian culture has as its aim to supplant professional architects with construction workers, artists with wall painters, writers and poets with printing workers."
"And what about the peasants?"
"Ah, the peasants cannot create a proletarian culture, and therefore we must cut ourselves off from them once and for all."
"Then what about our policy of alliance with the peasants?"
"Ah, that has nothing to do with proletarian culture. You see, comrades, we need to create a pure working class culture without the slightest rural influence. This indeed explains our attitude to the culture of the past. We reject it resolutely."
"You mean entirely?"
"Yes, entirely. If we even as much as touch the culture of the past and are not firm enough and uncompromising, it will not be the proletariat who will master this culture of the past. On the contrary, the culture of the past will take over the proletariat as human material for its own alien class interests. Let me give you an example. What will happen to you if you read a lot of books by, say, Turgenev, Tolstoy, Chekhov, or Dostoevsky, with their maudlin bourgeois notions? Your mind will fall under the influence of those people who are offspring of alien classes. And then what will happen? A process of reappraisal of proletarian values set in, and the excellent building material that you are and that are so vital for the creation of a new society will perish."
"Is this correct from a Marxist point of view?"
"Absolutely correct. Our Marxist attitude towards the culture of the past was very well expressed by our first proletarian poet, Kirillov. Just listen to these lines. By the passionate wine of revolt we are now overcome. Let them cry, we are killers of beauty. In the name of morrow, we may burn Raphael, smash museums and art at the call of duty.
Then how are we to understand the decrees of the Council of People Commissars on the preservation of old monuments? They say Lenin himself compiled the list of writers and artists of the past who are to have monuments erected to commemorate their names.
The question about proletarian culture in our party ranks and in Soviet government circles is not yet fully established. It is only in process of formation, but we are confident it will ripen soon. Take any bourgeois writer of the 19th century. They are always either counts or landowners themselves or people who side with them. What can they teach you?
That's right. We're sick and tired of Eugene Onegin.
It is possible that you proletarian women will cry over the fate of Countess Anna Karenina, this oversexed bourgeois dame. What do you have in common with her? Concretely speaking, what do you have in common with this seductress?
I don't know. She's probably a human being like myself.
That's just it. You see? Just what I told you. You're losing your proletarian point of view already. We don't need that kind of literature. The proletariat will dump it in the garbage can of history.
I once saw a painting of a forest by a pre-revolutionary artist. The forest was so captivating, I felt like I was there. How should I react to such a situation?
You liked that picture because you haven't developed a class approach to works of art. What concretely was the value of the painting you saw? Where does it encourage you to go? To the barricades? No, to the forest. But isn't it a bit early to indulge in such relaxation? No, comrades, such a picture is not conducive to our struggle. You're wrong to assume by asking that question that we need beautiful paintings which affect our emotions. Of course we'll need to grow beautiful forests later on, but that's a different thing altogether. Remember, comrades, the proletariat is not in need of emotion. It has no time to daydream. The proletariat needs art to create practical, concrete values now.
And what's going to happen to the theater?
The old theater must be destroyed. Anyone who fails to understand this is incapable of understanding anything.
What do you think of some newspapers which write that the proletariat may reproach us for destroying a lot of valuable art without first asking the proletariat itself?
Comrades, I already said, speak for yourself and not for the proletariat. Use your own heads for a change.
You never mentioned music. What about Tchaikovsky?
Tchaikovsky's music, comrades, is melancholy. Completely permeated with the psychology of the intellectual and is an expression of the anguish of an unfulfilled life. The proletariat has no need of such music.
How are we to treat the intellectuals of the old regime? Sometimes they offer us their services.
Tell them, go back to where you came from.
Okay. Now, it's important to remember, this was a play that was heavily produced in the Soviet Union in the 1970s. And it seems in our reading so comically ludicrous. And obviously there were still people in theater, according to the Ministry of Culture, who kept redoing a lot of the socially relevant and politically and revolutionary correct ideas, that Lenin's ideas were presented again and again and again. The stage, the setting for the stage is a huge hall in which 150 extras stand around in uniforms and flags and provide the spirit to the play. Now,
Michael,
yes.
Did people actually attend? I mean, did
yes.
The audiences really
yes.
come?
One of the things about theater, and I was talking to Emily last week, which was kind of interesting. One of the fears right now in the Soviet Union, particularly, and in other countries as well, is what will happen when the state no longer supports theater, when theater has to exist on its own, when the arts have to exist on their own without state support. And there's a real fear Because what's happening, there's already a drop-off in theater attendance in the Soviet Union. Because VCRs and Western videotapes are making... There was a person here from the Soviet Union, from Uzbekistan, who was at the village last week, and he said that the one thing that the Uzbekis wanted to take back were VCRs back, and our influence. And so there's a real fear, because theater was well attended, because you'd see a play like this, which employed lots of actors. And so the artists were employed, the actors were important, directors, scenographers, all the rest of it. And the audience came because there were also other entertainments and other plays. These weren't the only kind of plays, but these were attended because it was free, generally, or very, very cheaply. It was good entertainment, and there wasn't a lot of other things. They included in this lots of spectacle, too. So it was like going to a pep fest, I suppose. We would come and to see characters. So we look at it today, how could we possibly see such kind of didactic theater? But it's important to remember the tradition in Central European and Eastern European countries is different. Theater is a place of ideas. And for our Western minds, and one of the reasons I kind of am arguing strongly for the infusion of theater into Holden Village again, is that theater, I think, can present ideas and forms in a way that, even though they may be somewhat didactic, are presented in an entertaining manner, in a visual manner, that you can accept a lot of things and talk about, and it becomes a basis for talk. And that's what the purpose of theater was. I mean, a play like this might have caused a lot of debate in the 1970s about, do we want to really destroy art? I don't know. There wasn't that. By contrast, this is a book of plays called New Soviet Plays. This was published in 1989. And the difference is really striking. And what's really interesting, that as I was going through these plays, there is a playwright that's in this book who's also in this book. A playwright by the name of Alexander Gelman. And in both plays, his settings of his plays are factories. But in this book, the idea is to make the factory run smoothly, and the way to make the factory run smoothly is to make sure everyone has his or her place in the factory and the cogs all move smoothly. And anytime there's any disruption, things break down. This play also is set in a factory, but the whole point is that when things supposedly are running smoothly, they're really ineffectual, and production is down, and people's spirits are down, and there's lack of hope. Same playwright. Playwright under perestroika, playwright without perestroika. And it's really telling. I just like to give you a summary, and I'm not going to read plays from here. I'll read one short scene, but... The first play is called Heart of a Dog by Alexander Chervinsky. Chervinsky was alive in the early 20s. He wrote a novel called Heart of the Dog. The novel was banned by Lenin and the proletariat in the 20s. It was hidden by his wife under her bed for 60 years in a locked box. It was brought out. A few foreigners were allowed to read it. A British man made a carbon copy of the novel and smuggled it out of Russia in his shirt, and it was published in the West. But when perestroika came, three playwrights jumped at the novel immediately and turned it into a play. And the idea of the play is that a doctor, a scientific doctor, is trying to improve the state of things, and it's kind of a science fiction play. And so he picks a dog up off the street and takes a human cadaver and removes the heart, the brain, and the testicles of the man and plants them in the dog, and the dog turns into a man. But it's a new man, a scientific man, born out of this new, very rational state, which of course was a metaphor for what was happening in the revolution. And as soon as the dog becomes a mob, is to become a catcher and killer of cats. And which is a reference and a prediction of what happened during Stalin's reign, because Stalin, and now just recently, the Soviet Union admitted how many millions of people were killed during Stalin's regime. So it's kind of interesting. The next play is called Stars in the Morning, Stars in the Morning Sky, and it's set during the Olympics of 1980 in Moscow. And the play is about prostitutes. And what happened, and I don't know if most people know this, but before the Olympics in 1980, the Russians rounded up all the prostitutes off the streets of Moscow and took them to a labor camp so they could say our city is without corruption. And this is a play produced in Russia in about 1986 about that story, which is kind of interesting. Man with Connections is a play that takes place in the factory. Forget Herostratus is a play by Grigory Gorin, whose name is somewhat familiar in the West, who is one of the leading Soviet playwrights today. And it was done pre-Perestroika, but right towards the end, when artists were really starting to feel their oats. And it's about, it's set in ancient Greek times. And as a lot of political plays are, even Shakespeare's time, if you set it in another setting and you say this is a mythological story that happens somewhere else, it doesn't have anything to do with the political goings on, as Shakespeare did a lot with political goings on in Elizabeth's court. You were able to distance it, and so it's a very attacking play, but it's set in ancient Greek, and all the characters are Greek, and so obviously it couldn't be Russian. The last play is by the leading female playwright of the Soviet Union, and it's called Three Girls in Blue, and her last name is Ludmila Petrosheva, I think is how you say her last name. But the basic difference of what, and I'm going to read a scene from that, the basic difference between the object of culture and the subject of culture is that the subject of culture, the culture that keeps everything, keeps the art going, is that it's generally held in secret. And it's not always positive. In fact, it has a tendency to be much more negative. I want to read a quote by the 1983 Nobel Prize winner, Manas Berber. And some of you may know the name. He's a Jewish writer born in Poland who lived in Paris and wrote in German, in short, a real Central European. And he offers this analysis of what happens to human beings when they live under a government that deprives them of their dignity. Referring to Hitler's Germany, he asks, "What fears, horrors, and anxieties were dominating the consciousness and the conscious and unconscious life of a man during those times? What was his image of happiness? How did he conceive his ideal of personality? The theme of happiness is quickly exhausted, while fear, anxiety, and terror remain inexhaustible themes, no matter whether one thinks of exploring the life of an individual or society. And what generally you'll find in most political theater, and most theater that came out of the East and Central Europe, is this sense of kind of gloom. And I just want to read a little bit from Three Girls in Blue. And this is a woman who is an average peasant woman. And I think you'll see that there's not a lot of happiness. See that house on top of the hill? The one that looks like a two-story army hut? That's where the Blooms live. All the Blooms. I don't know how many times the downstairs Bloomses have been to court to get old man Valka Bloom out of the house. He lived in one room and nailed up the door into the next room, the room where Isabella Bloom died. She used to work for me at the kindergarten, taught music. She was terrible at it. Couldn't hardly stand on her feet. She'd stagger in, try to get her breath back, and then sit and cry into the soup because there's no serviettes to wipe her mouth with. She'd say, "I used to play at concerts, but now I can't even manage the sun over the homeland without making mistakes, believe me." "Fidorota," she'd say. She didn't need to tell me, I'm not deaf. I hear her sing, and if hearing is believing, she wasn't lying. There was a famine in that year, 1947, and one of my teachers couldn't help herself, started pinching things. I had to keep a sharp eye on all of them, I can tell you. She had a daughter who'd been bedridden since childhood. That's why she stole. Well, she was nicking apples from the kids and bread. Our kindergarten was on special rations for undernourished kids, you see. Anyway, there she is stuffing all her can into her stocking and keeping her stocking in her locker. "My cleaner," she said to me, "Yagrovna's got apples and things in her stocking. So we emptied Yagrovna's stocking and put wooden blocks in instead." So she took the stocking home like that, and that evening they had blocks of wood for their supper. Next day she left, and that was the time Isabella Bloom was dying in the hospital. I used to visit her there. I buried her. Now, in that, you'll see there's a comic edge and humor, but it's very dark. And the situation that she describes is not positive. It's not socialist realism. It's realism. And it's a concrete realism reflecting the life. And that's a lot of what you get in many plays today. So it's not always the positive, upbeat kind of feeling that pre-perestroika plays did. I'm going to read now, with help from Jan and Robert again, a little bit from a Vaclav Havel play. And some of you the other day were here and heard me read some things from Vaclav Havel, who is the playwright and president of Czechoslovakia. And this is a play that was written in 1984, during a period when Havel had just been released from prison. And it's probably his darkest play and his most depressing play, because he doesn't give much hope. There's humor in the play, but there's a sense of continuance of darkness. And what I'm going to do before I have Jan and Robert, and I'll read the last scene, I'm going to read the first two scenes, and they're very short. These are the first two scenes, and I think you can get the sense of what it's like for a writer who waits for the police to come in to carry him away because of his writing. As the music dies away, the curtain rises slowly. Leopold is alone on the stage. He is sitting on the sofa and staring at the front door. After a long pause, he gets up and looks through the peephole. Then he puts his ear to the door and listens intently. After another long pause, the curtain drops suddenly and the same music returns. Scene 2. As the music dies away, the curtain rises slowly. Leopold is alone on the stage. He's sitting on the sofa and staring at the front door. After a long pause, he gets up and looks through the peephole. Then he puts his ear to the door and listens intently. After another long pause, the curtain drops suddenly and the same music returns. Scene 3. Leopold is alone on the stage. He's sitting on the sofa and staring at the front door. After a long pause, he gets up, goes to the door and looks through the peephole, and then puts his ear to the door and listens intently. He evidently hears something which makes him jump back. At the same time, the doorbell rings. That's the beginning of the play. And one of the things that Havel does a lot in his writing is use circular construction. You'll see a little bit more of this. This is the last scene in the play. And throughout the play, the lead character, Leopold, in the play, is a philosopher whose writings have been taken by some and used as political protest statements. He was just kind of a bookworm, nerdish kind of writer, and suddenly he was elevated to this position of having his works really mean something. Well, he spent some time in prison. He was interrogated. And now he's been told to disavow all of his works, sign away his name. Sign his name saying that he didn't write what he wrote earlier, just give up his writing. And he's debating this and waiting, and the time goes by. Throughout the entire play, friends come, and they're concerned about his doing nothing, doing too little, doing too much, worrying about him in general, and he becomes sort of incapable of doing anything. And as the scene opens, we see a college student coming to visit Leopold.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Professor Nettles?
Yes.
Well, sorry to disturb you.
You're not disturbing me.
I won't hold you up for long.
I've got time.
My name's Marguerite. I'm a student of philosophy.
Oh, at the university or a private student?
Both.
Sit down.
I know your work.
Really? Which?
Phenomenology of Responsibility, Love and Nothingness, Ontology of the Human Self.
How, you've read all those?
Well, several times.
Well, I am impressed.
I hear that Ontology of the Human Self has got you into trouble.
It's because of that I'm supposed to go there.
What, straight there?
Paragraph 511, intellectual hooliganism.
Oh, that's awful.
That's the sort of world we're living in.
For such beautiful thoughts?
Apparently someone didn't think they were so beautiful.
And it is definite?
I could get out of it by denying that I wrote it.
Is that what they're offering?
Yes.
Well, they're disgusting. Your essays have given me a great deal of...
Yes. I'm so glad.
Well, it's because of them that I became interested in philosophy.
Really?
Somehow they opened my eyes.
Oh, you're exaggerating.
No, really.
Have another drink.
Are you writing anything?
I'm trying to.
Could you tell me... Well, excuse my curiosity. Could you tell me what you're writing?
I'm trying to think about love as a dimension of being.
You touched on that a little in the second chapter of Love and Nothingness.
That's right.
Professor.
Yes, Marguerite?
I wouldn't dare to trouble
you. Oh, you're not troubling me at all. On the contrary, I'm very pleased to have met you.
Well, if it wasn't for the fact that I'm sure you're the only one who can help me.
What's the matter?
Well, it's going to sound silly.
Oh, you can tell me.
I'm suddenly embarrassed.
But why? There's no need.
Where should I begin? I just don't know what to do.
In your studies?
With my life.
In your life?
I find everything so stifling. All those hopeless faces in the bus queues. The endless hue and cry in the streets, people twisted out of shape in their offices and everywhere else, the general misery of life. Forgive me, I know it's silly. You don't even know me, but I didn't know anyone else I could turn to.
Oh, I'm delighted you should confide in me.
Well, I don't get on with my parents. They're middle-class types who are always watching TV, and I've no boyfriend, and the other students seem terribly superficial.
I know what you mean.
Well, you're not angry?
Oh, why do you make excuses for yourself all the time? What greater satisfaction could there be for a philosopher than to receive a visit from a reader in mid-crisis about the meaning of life?
Well, I know that you can't solve my problems for me, but...
You're right in the sense that the meaning of life is not something which one can summarize or verbalize in one way or another and then hand over like a piece of information. It's not an object. It's more like an elusive spiritual state, and the more one needs it, the more elusive it becomes.
Oh, yes, that's exactly
right. On the other hand, there is the fact, as I've already tried to show in Ontology of the Human Self, that there's a certain non-verbal existential space in which, and only in which, one can get hold of something through experiencing the presence of another person.
Well, forgive me, but that's exactly the part of Chapter 4 which made me decide to come see you.
Yeah, there you are then. But I wouldn't like to raise your hopes unduly, because the fact that I'm meditating on this subject doesn't automatically mean that I am myself capable of creating such a space.
Oh, but you've been creating it for ages, by talking to me at all.
I'll be quite frank with you, Marguerite. I'm in a very bad way.
Well, I know that life has been hard on you, but you seem so strong.
Alas, that's only in appearance. In reality, I've had the feeling for some time now that something is collapsing inside me. As if an axis holding me together has started to break, the ground crumbling under my feet. I lack a fixed point from which everything inside could grow and develop. I get the feeling sometimes that I'm not really doing anything except listening helplessly to the time going by. Gone is the perspective I once had, my humor, my industry and persistence, the pointedness of my observations.
Beautifully you put it.
Ah, you should have known me before. It's all gone. My irony, my self-irony, my capacity for enthusiasm, for emotional involvement, for commitment, even for sacrifice. This might disappoint you, Marguerite, but for a long time I haven't been the person that you obviously take me for. Basically, I'm a tired, dried out, broken man.
Oh, you mustn't speak like that, Professor. You're too hard on yourself. But even if it were all true, the very fact that you're reflecting on your situation shows that all is not lost.
Ah, you're good to me, Marguerite. And please don't call me Professor. It sounds so formal.
Leopold, I believe that you will win through.
I have a feeling that my only way out is to accept a term there, somewhere far away from my nearest and dearest, and put my humble trust in a higher will to give me the chance to atone for my guilt, to lose my apathy and regain my pride as a nameless cog in a giant machine to purify myself. Thus, and only thus, if I manage to drain the bitter cup with dignity, I can get back, perhaps, something of my lost human integrity. Renew the hope inside me, reconstitute myself emotionally, open the door to a new life.
But Leopold!
Yes?
Well, don't you see that the punishment is deeply unjust, and that if you try, however honorably, to turn it into a purifying experience, you'll just be agreeing with it, and so prostrating yourself before it. And what's more, by giving into this so-called meaning, you're hiding from yourself the fact that you're clinging to it as a kind of escape from your life, a way out of your problems. But however far they send you, punishment won't solve what you can't solve yourself. Don't you understand that you've done nothing, and so there is nothing to atone? You're innocent.
Oh, Marguerite, why didn't I meet you before it was too late?
Leopold.
Yes?
Do you love anybody?
Oh, my dear girl. I really don't know if I'm capable of love.
Oh, don't tell me that you've never felt anything towards a woman.
Nervousness. And more with some, less with others.
You need love. Mad, passionate love. Didn't you yourself write in the Phenomenology of Responsibility that a person who doesn't love doesn't exist? Only love will give you the strength to stand up to them.
Ah, that's easy for you to say, Marguerite, but where would one find it?
With me.
What? You?
Leopold, I love you. I love your thoughts and your words. You awoke my love a long time ago without knowing it, without my knowing it. And now I will awaken love in you.
At that moment, the doorbell rings. Leopold jumps up at once.
Quick, go out on the balcony.
Why?
They'll drag you off.
Leopold takes her by the hand and hurries her to the balcony door. He opens the door and pushes her to the balcony and closes the door. He runs into the bedroom, leaving the door open. Pause. The doorbell rings again. Pause. Then Leopold, gray-faced, emerged from the bedroom, wearing a suit and an overcoat and carrying a small military valise. He goes to the front door, opens it bravely. First and second chap enter. On your own today?
Gentlemen, do your duty. I'll get ready.
What's the hurry? It may not come to the worst. First chap goes to the balcony door, opens it, and says, come in, my little one.
Don't you dare touch her. If you drag her off, then I'll...
What?
Then I'll...
Don't worry. There's no need for her to go anywhere. Today, there'd be no point.
You're right. As you're obviously aware, I'm not going to sign that statement. I'd rather die than give up my human identity. It's the only thing I've got.
But, Professor, why are you carrying on like this? You're not going anywhere.
Why not? I've told you quite clearly that I'm not going to sign anything. I'm not guilty.
You don't have to sign anything. Your case has been adjourned indefinitely. Indefinitely for the time being. For the time being. Without signature.
What? Adjourned?
That's right. Adjourned.
You mean no signature and no there, either?
For the time being, why? For the time being.
I don't understand what it means. Why don't you want my signature anymore?
It would just be a formality. Who needs it? It's become pretty clear by now, in your case, it would be superfluous.
Are you trying to say that I'm no longer me?
You said it, not me.
I don't want an adjournment. I want to go there. I'm begging you. I beseech you. I can't go on living like this.
It seems that you'll have to.
Leopold, get up. You're not going to beg them, are you?
Leave me alone. All of you, leave me alone.
Leopold collapses to the floor, banging his fists on it. The curtain falls. The curtain rises. Leopold is alone on the stage. He is sitting on the sofa, staring at the front door. After a longer pause, he gets up and goes to the door and looks through the peephole. Then he puts his ear to the door and listens intently. The lights start coming up in the auditorium, and the music begins to be heard. Thank you, Jan and Robert, for reading that. This play is sometimes held up to Havel as an autobiographical play, which it really is. And thankfully, I hope he doesn't feel that same kind of despair anymore. But it is, I think, a sense of what the political message is, that the living in fear, it's not plays written during this period aren't openly political in the sense of being heavily didactic. What they do instead is deal with issues of people living under systems of oppression. And that's what you'll find in all countries that live in depression. In oppression, the plays are about individual rights and liberties, fears of punishment, anxieties about self. And I think that was very clear in this scene. The final play I want to just read a little bit from is a comedy by the other major Czechoslovakian writer, and one of the Pavel Kohout. sometimes we think in the West all we know is Havel as writer. We probably, and some of you may have never even heard of him as a playwright before, if you've, or just in brief mention. We don't know the literature that exists out there. But the literature more and more is beginning to be published and produced in the West. This is a play called Fire in the Basement. And it's a play that is set in a basement apartment in Czechoslovakia, and the people would know this more. And it's very, it's set in a realistic format, but it has this sense of absurdity. It's a young couple who are on their honeymoon, and the beginning of the play just shows the couple in bed, and all you see are feet and legs in bed. And suddenly, this fire bell rings, and a fireman on a pole comes sliding down through the ceiling. And all of a sudden, this couple are caught with these firemen coming in. And the firemen say, there's a fire here, there's a fire here in the room. They open up the door to the kitchen, and they go, oh, boy, it's really bad in there. And the couple says, well, shouldn't we get out of here? No, we've got some questions. And they bring in more, they bring in all these appliances. They bring in a shield, they bring in a bomb squad, they fill the apartment with all these appliances. And meanwhile, they put a ladder through the basement window, so they're constantly sliding down the pole and climbing up the ladder and all the, and they have radio microphones in their helmets, and they're asking, do we need to bring in this? Do we need to bring in the SWAT team? Do we need... And this poor couple is caught, and for most of it they don't have their clothes on even, finally, the fireman says to the wife, as they're putting their clothes on finally, and there was some debate about what clothes they have, and their clothes is their wedding clothes, the wedding dress and the formal tux, and the wife says to her husband, pull up my zipper at least. And the husband says, listen, shouldn't we get out of here? Why didn't you go out for 3 days? Is that so difficult to figure out when we were married the day before yesterday? Insofar as you are married. Did you notice the clothes we're wearing? Insofar as they belong to you. What? Insofar as the real groom and the real bride are not also, and he points to the door where the fire supposedly is. But that's Commander. Mister, okay, let's say, Engel, fire is the best detective because it often turns up the right place at the right time. Once we had a case where a guy had knocked off his aunt and he was just pouring gas all over her. And there's our fireman, Hernick, hanging in his window in order to tell him the house was on fire beneath him. Suddenly a horn sounds twice, and from the door to the other room, accompanied by thick black smoke, another fireman comes in. The head fireman, how does it look? The other fireman gives him a thumbs down sign and mumbles, gotcha. Then the wife says, did he get the handbag that included all her money? First things first, Miss, okay, let's say Mrs. Anglova, insofar as you are Mrs. Anglova, you must know what's behind that door. The kitchen, of course. Is that right, Hernick? The other fireman nods. What's in the kitchen? Clothes cabinet, kitchen cabinet, refrigerator, and the oven. Hernick? The other fireman nods. What's in the oven? Nothing. And in the refrigerator? Vodka, beer, and a roast duck. This, and the fireman lists a charcoal object which might have been a bird at some point. I don't believe it. Is that what it's like in there? I thought you claimed you could just sweep it up. Where was the duck, Hernick? Hernick, the other fireman mumbles. Understood. Will be reported. Wait a second. Hold the report. And the wife objects to them calling in. I'm absolutely sure that I turned off. That the duck... Again, the fireman holds up the charcoal skeleton. I told you to take the duck out, dear. Didn't I tell you that or not? But And the wife breaks into tears. And then she asks how the fire started. Oh, don't blame the little woman too much, Mr. Engel. Things like that happen to people with more experience too, you know. Once we had a case where a lady forgot to turn off the oven. She heard, she confessed, and she promised it never happen again. Right, young lady? The woman cries even more. And the fireman hands a sheet. Sign at the bottom left. The husband takes the pen. Yes. Don't you want to read it through? No, what's the point? Read it out loud. You see how excited the two of them are. The fire was caused by reckless neglect of the female renter of the apartment in failing to switch off duck in oven, right? But that's pretty, couldn't you somehow, somehow tone it down for my wife's sake? Oh, I like that, Mr. Engel. I like it when a family sticks together. Towards that cutout oven, it's not necessary. How does it read now? The fire was caused by reckless neglect of the female renter of the apartment in failing to switch off duck. Okay, satisfied, Mr. Engel? Yeah, sure, but does my wife have to be nice so directly mentioned? I really like that in you, Mr. Engel. I wouldn't leave my wife in the lurch either. Cross out female renter of the apartment. We don't need that. Roger. How do we read now? The fire was caused by reckless neglect in failing to switch off duck. Well, see, everything right now? Yeah, sure. Only if it wasn't so clearly stated that somebody was negligent.